tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 28th of May, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's Thursday once again, which means it's Geopolitical Analyst Day, which means we have with us our resident geopolitical analyst, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from RussJournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well for a couple of reasons. First of all, I missed last week due to a colonoscopy. And I tell you, you guys who are afraid of it, you have nothing to be afraid of. It was simple. It was easy. It was no big deal. Just get it done, because if that kind of cancer doesn't have symptoms, and God forbid our listeners get caught with stage four rectal cancer and don't know it. The second reason is that this Ladislav Zemanyik is shockingly similar to myself in his professional trajectory. I was never a communist, but that's not a fair, because he's from Czechia, the Czech Republic. But he has really followed in my footsteps. I don't know, not deliberately. His English, I'm not sure. I think is okay. At that level of education, I think it's all right. But if anyone knows him, because he's a part of the European wide nationalist and conservative movement that Le Pen started, if anyone knows him, please send this to him, because he is definitely my mini-me for all those who like Mike Myers and Austin Powers.
So you quite like reading this fellow. I wasn't quite sure whether you liked the guy or whether you weren't that impressed with him, because you certainly have lots of criticisms for him. This Ladislav Zemanyik, it's his notes that we're going to be using today, and we're basically going to be talking about the recent summit between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. And this is the report on that by Zemanyik. He's a 33-year-old scholar at the Valdai Discussion Club, which is Russia's answer to Davos. As you just mentioned then, Matt, he was a communist activist in Chechnya in 2010 to 2011, but converted to orthodoxy once he saw the bankruptcy of Marx. He was even an election observer in the Donbass Republics, saying they were all free and fair. Talking about the Jews got him arrested, but since it was scholarly, he was set free. He is both a conservative and a nationalist. So he was in Russia, was he, when he was talking about the Jews? What law was that? Was that the law about not investigating World War II? Is that the one? Because I remember that was quite a famous case, wasn't it, which you talked about, which a lot of people are still not aware of. Was this the same fellow? And do you want to just repeat what happened in that case just while we bring it up?
No, this was in Czechia, the Czech Republic. Nazarov is a guy who I quote constantly in Russia, who the Jews tried to get in trouble. But there, the law is such that if it's not actual incitement, it's okay. It was deemed perfectly acceptable criticism of Jews, and he's a heavy critic of the Jews because he uses mostly Jewish sources. And he does so in a clear, scholarly way. He's not going, calling them kikes and stuff like that. But in this case, it was in Czechia, which I think has a vaguely similar system. Actually, let me put it this way: he was convicted, but he was given a suspended sentence, so he didn't spend a day in jail. But very upsetting to the regime again, because he's a scholar. and you approach this in a scholarly way, at least in Eastern Europe, you don't get into trouble. In Russia, if you're a scholar, you don't get into trouble. And that's been the precedent that Nazarov and many others have done. So the Holocaust laws, et cetera, are not the same in Eastern Europe as they are in the West.
Yeah, that is a point that needs to be made. I think you're the only person that actually makes that point, that if you're actually investigating this from a scholarly viewpoint, then you will be safe in Russia. It's not the same as the Holocaust denial laws that we have in the EU. Anyway, getting back to this summit and these notes that we have here from Ladislav Zemanek, the recent summit between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping sent another wave of panic through Western political and media circles on both sides of the Atlantic. The growing partnership between Russia and China is habitually described as an authoritarian alliance plotting against the regime. Headlines drip with warnings about a new anti-Western axis. Think tanks speak in apocalyptic tones. Liberal commentators invoke a new Cold War. But beneath the hysteria lies a simpler reality. The old world order is losing its grip. The Russia-China partnership is not a crusade against the West. It is a revolt against unipolarity, against the idea that one civilization, one ideology, and one political model should dominate the entire planet indefinitely. Moscow and Beijing are not trying to destroy the international system. They are building alternatives to an order monopolized for decades by Western liberal powers. The distinction matters enormously. What Putin and Xi are advancing is the idea of a multipolar world, a world where civilizations, nations, and cultures can pursue their own paths without ideological supervision from Washington, Brussels, or transnational liberal institutions. Far from threatening Europe and America, this transformation could ultimately save them from their own political and civilizational exhaustion. Well, all of that we've been talking about for quite some time here, Matt, but I can see that you put in lots of notes in italics about what he's saying here. This is why I was saying I couldn't tell whether you were being critical of him or you thought highly of him, because you seem to be quite shocked that this is news to him, because we've been talking about it ever since you've been here on Radio Albion, and you put in your notes there that you've been talking about this for at least 25 years. So do you want to make some comments on this?
Well, in this first set of paragraphs, I didn't realize, you know, who Zemanek really was. And it's my own arrogance where I think just because I've been talking about it for 30 years, he's 33 years old. For young people, this is new. Now, he's saying that the regime has just discovered this, which, of course, is nonsense. They've known about it for many years. This has been a concern of mine. Since grad school. That was even before Putin. Back then, I thought it would be Alexander Lebed, General Lebed, who was going to be the leader. Putin eventually became after Lebed was murdered. But their alliance, and I say here, you know, elsewhere, that their alliance goes way back, even before the USSR. So there's nothing new here. But I didn't realize how young he was when I put these in the very beginning of the article. Still, I mean, you know, it's not a crusade against the West. Yeah, it kind of is. But I think of how I was thinking when I was 33. And I don't mind. You know, again, I want someone to send this to him if you know him, because he is a major activist in the right-wing movement in Europe. But I didn't know how young he was. And I was younger than 33 when I started talking about this. But again, he was a communist for a long time. It is new to younger people. So I got to keep that in mind sometimes.
When Russia and China first issued a joint declaration on multipolarity in 1997, few in the West took it seriously. At the time, the Soviet Union was gone. American power appeared unstoppable, and liberal globalization seemed destined to swallow the planet whole. Borders were supposed to fade. National sovereignty was increasingly portrayed as obsolete. Globalization accelerated whilst NATO marched steadily eastwards. The declaration that they made said, every country has the right independently to choose its path of development in the light of its own specific conditions and without interference from other states. Differences in their social systems, ideologies and value systems must not become an obstacle to the development of normal relations between states. All countries, large or small, strong or weak, rich or poor, are equal members of the international community. No country should seek hegemony, engage in power politics, or monopolize international affairs. And I can't help but just think there that, you know, the American answer to that would be, yes, well, this is the loser talking. It's only ever the person that loses out on this that wants equality. It's only because they're at the bottom of the pile. If they're at the top of the pile, they wouldn't be wanting this equality. And effectively what they do is they pretend that we have this equality when we don't actually have this equality. Do you want to just make a comment on that, Matt, before I continue?
I do. I distinctly remember when that came out. I was still a grad student at University of Nebraska-Lincoln. It was in May of 1997. I brought it up to a few people, and it was kind of waved away because the professors there were well aware of what they're talking about. This is nationalism. This is, or at best, regionalism. And remember, 1997, Russia had defaulted on its debts. Russia had become third world. Russia was losing population at a huge clip. Alcoholism, crime, the oligarchs had ruled totally. This disgusting Boris Yeltsin and the Jews who worked under him were destroying the country. So, you know, you had factions within the military and the political system talking like this. But so long as Russia was poor and dying, it was acceptable. This paragraph that you just read here, that pretty much became the standard for everything else in multipolarity later on. But I distinctly remember bringing it up even to some big names, and they said, no, we are not going to get involved in this fascist model or something like that. They knew exactly what they were talking about. And even some of them said, Russia's not going to be around in a few years. So what difference does it make?
Well, this was about 30 years ago, if it was about 1995, 1996, 30 years ago that they wrote that. Russia and China already sensed the weakness hidden beneath the triumphalism. Even at the height of American dominance, both powers understood that a world organized around a single ideological center would eventually generate instability, arrogance, overreach, and backlash, which is exactly what happened. Endless wars, regime change interventions, financial crises, deindustrialization, mass migration, censorship, social fragmentation, and cultural nihilism slowly eroded confidence in the liberal model itself. Nearly 30 years later, Putin and Xi have returned to the same historical idea, only now from a position of far greater strength. At their latest summit, the two leaders adopted a new joint declaration on the multipolar world order and the reform of global governance, a manifesto on sovereignty, shared security, openness, intercivilizational dialogue, and democratization of international relations. More profoundly, it rejects the belief that liberal modernity represents the only legitimate destiny for mankind. This is what truly terrifies liberal elites. The emerging Eurasian vision challenges Western geopolitical dominance, as well as the very ideological foundations of the post-Cold War order itself. It insists that humanity is composed of many civilizations, not one universal civilization governed by a single moral and political doctrine. Now, what you're saying there, Matt, I mean, that really does make a lot of sense, doesn't it? That all the while that Russia was living in poverty, it really didn't matter that Russia was having these ideas. But the world that we live in today, Russia has been pushed into working closer with China and working with India. And now it is a multipolar world, whether they like it or not. Half the world is supportive of Russia's, or at least not condemning Russia's actions in the Ukraine, for instance. And I guess what they're really just doing is, as it says here, they're just reaffirming what they said 30 years ago. But now it's 30 years later. China is, I think, the biggest economy in the world. And you've now got Russia that's producing everything that it needs for itself. And it doesn't need the West anymore. So this talk of a multipolar world is now actually starting to take place. So it was very prescient of them to be foretelling this 30 years ago, I think. Any thoughts on this, Matt?
Yeah, I remember, in the 90s, prior to Putin's ascendancy, that Russia, at least potentially, has everything it needs to be the leader against the New World Order. We called it New World Order back then. It has the resources, it has the people, it has the anti-Western mentality. And I was right. It's just being run by people who rig elections and who are trying to just simply... stripping the economy as much as they can. Regardless of what our listeners may think of Putin, I don't know how else you could think of him, but he took a dying third world country, and within a few years, it became a powerful nation again. And today, it's the fourth largest economy in the world. You're right. China is number one. U.S. is number two. And Russia is number four. If you use purchasing power parity as a measure, and you should use purchasing power parity for a lot of reasons, but Russia is highly diverse. It is not based on – I mean, the exports are often based on oil and petroleum gas, but internally, it's a highly diverse economy, making – unlike the U.S., it's an industrialized economy. And this alliance, Russia and China, goes back to the 19th century. Other than the Sino-Soviet split, they've been allies for a long time. So there's really nothing new about this. And when you have India now joining this alliance, I wrote my first paper on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization 20 years ago. It's a security group, security organization. Oh, he's right. It terrified the regime. And every meeting between these leaders is just one more nail in the coffin. And, of course, now they brought Iran in. Iran's always been there. Iran's a first world state. It's always been there. This is also the center of the axis of resistance, not just Iran and Hezbollah. It's all of this. Hezbollah was financed. Hamas was financed by Russia and to a lesser extent, China. Iran had their much of its weapon systems from Russia. So there's a lot of reasons. But, The unipolarity issue, I was in college when the Soviet Union collapsed overnight, pretty much. No warfare, nothing. It just, boom, it just went, it imploded. My view at the time, I was 20 years old, was that running the planet is very expensive. There's always going to be wars. And the American population, how many wars are they expected to fight without a draft? And at the time, they were cutting back on military spending, the so-called peace dividend. And so it simply can't last. Planet-wise, it can't last. Now, of course, we know even I was correct, but still, it's more severe. The difficulties are more severe than even I expected. Donald Trump seems to have this naive view. He still thinks it's 1993, and he does. A lot of people in Washington do, and everything has changed since then. And Putin is at the center of it. Deng Xiaoping in China is at the center of it many years ago. And there's nothing authoritarian about these systems any more than in the U.S. or Britain, as we all know. But what they promote here is nationalism, both religious and ethnic, and racial, if that's what nations want. And of course, the U.S. cannot stand that.
Well, the West wants to force its views upon everybody else. I mean, if you think of the amount of resources that have gone into trying to censor individuals' opinions, throwing people in prison for having a different opinion, for disagreeing with certain government policies, and you think they're effectively trying to force that on the whole world. They're trying to get entire countries to go along with this liberal idea. And, of course, they don't want to go along with it. They don't want to trans their children. They don't want homosexuality being taught to children at school. They can see that that's just harmful to the nation. Why would they want to go along with it? As many problems as the West has with trying to force these ideas on the individuals and getting the individuals to go along with them, it's going to be 10 times worse trying to force it on all the other countries around the world. I mean, it just seemed doomed from the very start to try and force this one world order upon everybody. Did you want to say something there, Matt?
Yes, I do. And I wanted to say that I'm talking to one of the martyrs of that system, I'm proud to say. I was going to make a joke saying, yeah, what do you know about going to jail for disagreement? I'm speaking with, and don't forget that, I'm speaking to one of the martyrs of that very system. And it's getting worse, as we talked about before the show, with the stabbing and everything else. Britain is ruled by its non-white, I guess for now, minority, which, of course, was the plan all along. So you're not even talking about the same countries in the West that are supposed to rule the planet. That was very different in 1990. The U.S. cannot do a Operation Desert Shield or Storm like they did in 1991. They don't have that capacity anymore. The British cannot do what they did in 82 in Falkland Islands. They don't have that capacity for a whole bunch of reasons. I want to reiterate the fact that its leadership – Putin in Russia, Lukashenko in Belarus, and the list of leaders, Deng Xiaoping, all the way straight up to Xi today, that maintained. And they're all successful models. They all did much better than places like Ukraine, for example. So it's because they're successful models that the regime despises them.
So I guess because they're successful models, it shows that, you know, that their way of doing things functions. Whereas if you look at the West, it's completely in debt. It's completely dysfunctional. You know, the system that the West has been shown to be a complete failure. And yet they're just hanging on to it for grim life. Getting back to the quotes here, in many ways, the Putin-Xi vision resembles a genuinely Schmittian pluriversum, a world of sovereign civilizational states rather than a homogenized global marketplace administered by technocrats, NGOs, and supranational bureaucracies. In this world, nations are not expected to abandon their traditions, religions, or historical identities in the name of abstract universalism. Diversity among civilizations is treated not as a problem to be erased, but as a reality to be respected. That is one of the things, isn't it? You know, the West likes to talk about diversity all the time, but it's not actual diversity. It just wants everywhere to look the same. It wants it all to be corporatized, McDonald's everywhere. It looks at everybody as if they're just a financial unit to make money for that country. And in that aspect, they don't want diversity at all. But yet what it's talking about here is the diversity that there is between different civilizations, different cultures, the diversity that Europe once had. You know, every European country was different to the other. It had a different culture. That's what they're trying to stamp out. That's what's so insidious. They'll talk in glowing terms about diversity, which, while in actual fact, what they are the complete enemies of diversity. Well, particularly striking was the Declaration's recognition of the constitutive and positive role of religion in civilizational development and renewal. At a time when many Western institutions treat Christianity and religious tradition as embarrassing remnants of the past, Russia and China acknowledge spiritual inheritance and cultural continuity as pillars of social cohesion and meaningful intercivilizational dialogue. Well, this is interesting to me because China, communism, is supposed to be atheistic. So what religion are they talking about in China, Matt? Is it Buddhism? Is that what he's referring to there?
Yeah, I have a book that eventually, one day, on China that's coming out. China is not a communist country. Just because the name of the party is communist doesn't mean anything. As Willis Cardo said, he was the first one to tell me it is a national socialist state. Buddhism is the issue. I have a section in there on Tibet. China has financed the rebuilding of their monasteries, of their libraries that were destroyed under, of course, Mao Zedong, who was an animal, and has rebuilt this. They have freedom of religion, except for the Protestant weirdos, who the evangelicals, who are often connected to Mossad or the CIA. Orthodoxy certainly is seen as a friend. And I remember saying in public back in the late 90s, you know, when Russia and China, I was thinking in terms of Russia, when Russia becomes the leader of the resistance, which of course it is now, so does Orthodoxy, which changes everything in terms of global religion. China is not a Marxist state. Every once in a while, they say something that, you know, the revolution was wonderful, but that doesn't mean that's just a tripe. It's they're you know, they have private property, they have private press, they have, you know, you can't be a Maoist if you have private property. And they avoided the collapse of Eastern Europe, and instead brought the country to a nationalist, a Han nationalist a world that was incredible. You can't get any more successful than China. And Chinese are spending a fortune in Tibet, not just for religion, but for everything else. They try to equalize the western and eastern parts of the country. And you know, the Tiananmen Square massacre is a myth. It never occurred. NBC has finally admitted that. And there is no religious oppression of Buddhism in Tibet, unless it's simply, you know, violently opposed to China. China has always chosen the Dalai Lama for God knows how many centuries. And without Peking, without Beijing, these monasteries in Tibet would not exist today. Again, it's unfortunate that Mao did destroy them. But there's this tradition of Russo-Chinese or Sino-Russian alliance. In the 19th century, it was against British colonialism, you know, which, you know, had its jumping point in India, and especially after the Opium Wars. There was a clear concern about I say British, even though it was a Jewish Sassoon family from France, but so this is, you know, and then the minute this guy said Smithian perversium, I said, okay, wait a minute. He's one of us. Anyone who mentions Carl Schmitt and all that. And the perversium is a very simple idea. It's international rather than global, because international implies that nations still exist but just cooperate. Global implies that you just have individuals and no identities, which is exactly what the regime wants. That's what globalization is. A pluriversium is perfectly acceptable. You mentioned it yourself. If there were no non-whites in the British Isles, you have a tremendous amount of diversity just from Celtic and everything else. Far more than these ignoramuses will ever know. Several languages, in fact. So when he mentioned Carl Schmitt, I said, okay, I got to pay attention to this guy. He's probably one of us, and he is one of us.
So would you say that they consider Buddhism to be one of the Chinese characteristics when they call it socialism with Chinese characteristics then?
Yes. It's not an official religion. I mean, Russia has it as one of its official religions. China does not, but it is certainly more than tolerant towards it.
Getting back to the notes here. That message will resonate far beyond the two countries. Across Europe and the US, millions increasingly feel alienated by borderless economies, bureaucratic managerialism, cultural deracination, collapsing communities, demographic anxiety, and the aggressive moralism of liberal ideology. They are told that national identity is dangerous, tradition oppressive, religion backwards, and sovereignty obsolete. Yet the more the liberal order promises liberation, the more fragmented and rootless Western societies become. Putin and Xi are speaking into that vacuum. I just say the more the liberal order promises liberation, the more repression that you get, the more censorship that you get, the more they promote sexual liberation, the more they stick people in jail for protesting against the result of that liberation and the increase in rapes and multiculturalism and immigration, all the problems associated with that, and they stick people in jail for complaining about it. So where is this liberation? Where is this liberation that they speak of? We don't have it. We just have a massive repression in the West. The Ukraine conflict accelerated historical processes already underway. Western governments unleashed unprecedented sanctions against Russia, expecting economic collapse and political destabilization. Instead, Russia adapted. Its economy diversified, redirected eastwards, and survived the largest sanctions regime in modern history. And you've got some notes there in italics, Matt. Do you want to just bring them up there about the economy?
Yes, I've already mentioned that Russia is the fourth largest economy in the world, purchasing power parity, which I think most people use in general. But I also mentioned the PMI index, or actually, you know, indexed already in the PMI, Purchasing Managers Index. I don't believe Westerners when they talk about GDP. I think it's manipulated. I think the thing, but purchasing managers, these are the people who every month are polled and have to send in their data, shipping, inventories, etc. And there's a scale where anything over 50 is expansion, anything under 50 is contraction. Russia has always been over 50 in recent years. The U.S. has been under for some time. Germany at 48.5, which is awful. It always, you know, hovers around 50. And France, 43.8. And this isn't from abstract statistics. These are from the guys who do the shipping, that do the inventories that are polled. They send data every month or every quarter. And this is a tremendous a way to cancel GDP figures or to check GDP figures, because this really is economic growth or economic collapse. Russia has grown through the war. But France at 43.8 is awful. That's extremely low.
I was just going to say, I mean, we know Germany's economy has completely crashed because it was getting cheap gas and cheap oil from Russia. In fact, a lot of Europe was getting sweetheart deals from Russia. So all these sanctions have actually done is they've just harmed the European economies. Getting back to the notes here, China played a decisive role in that outcome, providing for trade expansion, deeper financial cooperation, increased technology exchanges, and new logistical and commercial corridors. Predictably, Western commentators portrayed this as Beijing enabling Russian aggression. But China's calculations are far more strategic. Chinese leaders understand that sanctions have evolved from exceptional measure into instruments of systemic coercion. Asset seizures, financial exclusion, and economic warfare create precedents that can eventually be used against any state unwilling to submit to Western political demands. Thus, Beijing's support for alternative financial systems doesn't only help Russia, it is a defense of sovereign autonomy in an increasingly weaponized global economy. So this is the reason why they had to have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the separate banking system that we've talked about, the alternative to SWIFT. I mean, because of what happened when Russia went into Ukraine, they shut down all the banking. But Russia was already prepared for that because it had already had all these sanctions and it had already been working with China and other countries to set up a separate banking system to prevent the West from doing this, because I think they always knew that the West was, keeping their fingers crossed behind their backs when they were actually making these treaties and making these deals. I mean, how can you trust the West with your money anymore after seeing what happened in Libya when they just hijacked the entire Libyan sovereign wealth fund? And now they've hijacked all the money that belonged to Russians outside of Russia, impounding their yachts and all of this other shenanigans that they should never have got up to if you're going to have this banking system that everybody is going to be able to use. So because they knew this was going to happen, they worked and came up with these ways to get around this. So the end result of the sanctions on Ukraine is Russia much stronger than it was before. Any comments on this, Matt?
You couldn't be more correct. And it goes to show how ignorant policymakers were in Washington and in New York. They thought this was actually going to work. It's one thing for sanctions on Panama that's, you know, dependent on the U.S. or Venezuela. Okay, that's one thing. But Russia was never dependent. Russia's not dependent on anybody. They were building Eastern ties since Tsar Nicholas II. Moving, you know, to an Eastern orientation was no problem. That's where the regime continues to rule. There was an attempt to coerce Russia. And my big fear, I have to say, is if sanctions are lifted, there's been some limited lifting of sanctions on oil due to the Iranian thing. My fear is if sanctions are lifted, those westernizers that are still around will want to reattach to the Western economy, which would be a disaster. They need to maintain. So I like sanctions at this point. At this point, sanctions are a net positive for Russia. Maybe not in the very beginning. You know, Russia didn't trade much with the U.S. Third-party sanctions, a different story, but you can't enforce third-party sanctions. You know, sanctioning countries that do business with Russia. They tried to do this with India, and India wasn't particularly happy about being bullied by the British and the Americans. And that just brought them closer together. Interestingly, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has both India and Pakistan as members. Only Putin could do something like this. Only that alliance could do something like this, bring them together and cooperating here, because they both know who their enemies are. The Indian military is mostly Russian design. Now it's their own design. Pakistan is mostly Chinese and Russian. Some of it's their own. So it's been a tremendous benefit. And I just worry about if they're ever lifted, what might happen. And there has been limited sanction relief so to keep the oil prices low. It just shows you the power that Russia has globally.
It just shows you the oil prices should be low anyway. We shouldn't have these ridiculous sanctions on Russia. It's destroyed the German economy, just for start. Other economies in Europe as well. They just voluntarily self-destructed. I mean, that's really the point of this article, pretty much. Well, this explains the growing importance of BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, trade in national currencies, and independent payment infrastructures. As I say, that's the important one, the independent payment infrastructures that don't necessarily have to go through the Western ones. These initiatives are designed to create resilience and strategic flexibility. Even the West could benefit from this type of system. A world in which economic interdependence cannot be weaponized so easily may ultimately prove more stable than one governed by coercive monopolies. Ironically, it's liberal globalization itself that created this fragmentation. The same elites who once preached open markets and global integration now advocate censorship, sanctions, decoupling, industrial protectionism, and ideological conformity. The supposedly universal liberal order has revealed itself to be highly selective, punitive, and openly political. Russia and China simply adjusted to reality faster than the West did. The geopolitical importance of Sino-Russian relations cannot be overstated. Together, Russia and China dominate the strategic core of Eurasia, the largest landmass on Earth. Their shared border stretches further than any other in the world. Both are nuclear powers, permanent members of the UN Security Council, and civilizations with deep historical memory. What many Western analysts still fail to grasp is that this partnership is not historically abnormal. If anything, it corrects decades of imbalance. After the Cold War, Russia looked overwhelmingly towards Europe and the US. China became economically intertwined with America. Even today, despite rising tensions, China's economic relationship with the US remains far larger than its trade with Russia. Matt, you've talked about this before as well. In fact, you were mentioning it on this podcast as well about the ancient link and amity that there was between Russia and China. Do you want to go into that some more?
Yeah, the I think it was the 11th Dalai Lama called, you know, read the prophecy for the great white czar, or the great white monarch from the north that was going to save them from their enemies. And Nicholas II was given that title. And this is why Buddhism has always been, you know, taken so seriously in even in Western parts of Russia. This and China as well. China needed protection from the Japanese. Of course, there was a point where Russia was in no position to do so. For the most part, they have always been allies. Japan was built up by the British and the Americans, and it created the 1905 war, Russo-Japanese War, which neither side won, by the way. It was not a loss for Russia. There were riots in the streets of Tokyo because they believed they had lost the war. The commanding admiral at Port Arthur had killed himself, and due to shame, because it's all based on mythical ideas. But also, but it's very important. You know, since these sanctions were first put on by Obama, I've been following them closely. We've been following them closely. I've seen what's happened in real time, and what we have now is an American consumer economy that's not, you know, China can diversify itself now. China is not dependent on the American market. They've already proven that. Its trade with Russia is strategic in the sense that it's mostly high-tech equipment and military high-tech equipment, not to mention, you know, oil and things like that. But so much of China's high-tech sector comes from the Russians, not from anywhere else. And the rare earth minerals, which we used to hear so much about, China has almost a monopoly on them, and a total monopoly on their processing. They have to be processed. You can't just grab them out of the ground. Ukraine does not have them like the U.S. pretended they did. China is very dominant in that regard. Venezuela, by the way, also has a few. That group of minerals essential to the so-called digital economy, China is absolutely in control. And besides all that, China has a huge amount of American debt, and they keep dumping it. If the U.S. gets too arrogant, they could dump it all. What's going to happen is, you know, the dollar is always in trouble, but if they dump it all, Russia was the war has some short term debt for Russia, but otherwise Russia is a creditor nation. They dump it all. Russia and China together have massive gold reserves. The U.S. has nothing. There is nothing in Fort Knox. Well, that belongs to the U.S., that is. They have pieces of paper that say gold on it, but that's about it. Power has gone to the East and to these countries, and for very good reason. They're nationalist societies or national socialist societies.
Your nature will always correct an imbalance. If you get some international ideology, eventually it's going to cause an overreach, and nationalism is going to come back into that void that's created by the overreach. And you can't go against the laws of nature, which is what liberalism effectively does. It's what internationalism does. The real geopolitical paradox here is that Western elites simultaneously pursued confrontation with both powers while expecting them not to align strategically. By opening a two-front struggle against Russia and China at the same time, the liberal establishment accelerated precisely the Eurasian partnership it feared the most. Europe has suffered the greatest consequences. As European governments severed ties with Moscow, China gained privileged access to Russian energy, raw materials, agricultural exports, military technology, chemicals, and Arctic trade routes. Europe voluntarily surrendered strategic advantages, while Beijing and India stepped into the vacuum. In many respects, Europe is financing its own geopolitical marginalization. future European leaders may eventually realize that permanent confrontation with Russia serves neither Europe's prosperity nor its security. A stable Eurasian balance built on cooperation rather than ideological crusades would benefit the entire continent. The greatest misunderstanding surrounding multipolarity is the belief that it means the destruction of the West. And you've put there, the West is doing that by itself. As I say, I think that's really the point of this article here. In reality, it may represent the only path towards Western renewal. For decades, liberal globalism hollowed out the very foundations of Western civilization. National sovereignty gave way to supranational and corporate bureaucracy. Manufacturing disappeared. Borders weakened. Communities fragmented. Endless foreign interventions drained public trust and money. Cultural atomization replaced social solidarity. Under liberal universalism, nations themselves were expected to dissolve into a borderless order. Ordinary Europeans and Americans increasingly reject that vision. They want continuity, identity, security, tradition, and meaningful sovereignty. The same principles Moscow and Beijing now defend openly on the world stage. This does not mean the West must imitate Russia or China. That kind of uniformity would go against the very idea of multipolarity. Civilizations should be free to develop according to their own histories, traditions, and moral frameworks without external ideological enforcement. Russia, China, Europe, and even the US are not natural civilizational enemies. In many respects, they share a common adversary, liberal globalism, and the transnational class that weakened sovereignty, eroded traditions, shattered social cohesion, and subordinated nations to abstract universalist dogmas. And that's basically telling America is all about ideas. Or if you just share the same values of the country you live in, that means that you're British. Or just because you've got a bit of paper that says you're a citizen of that nation, that means that's your nation. No, it doesn't. I mean, that's this universalist idea which shatters social cohesion. The Putin Xi summit, therefore, symbolized the accelerating transition from a world organized around ideological uniformity to one grounded in civilizational plurality. Western elites may resist this transformation for years to come, but history rarely reverses course. The unipolar era is ending, and it wasn't Russia or China that destroyed it. Liberal globalism exhausted itself from within. A balanced world of sovereign civilizations, distinct cultures, and multiple centers of power does not threaten Europe or America. It may offer the only viable path towards restoring their own civilizational confidence. And I say this makes a lot of sense to most people, that we don't want internationalism, we want nationalism, and that's effectively what this is saying. Matt, what are your final thoughts on this today?
Well, you notice I wrote there, I said, oh my God, I feel like I'm 35 again. I gotta contact this guy and get him on Radio Albion. Because this is exactly what I was saying then. You know, because he's a young man, he's saying it now to his generation. This has been the shortest existing empire. The liberal empire of the U.S. and Britain is the shortest empire, I think, in history. Every war the U.S. is involved in is a loss. The economy is so bad that the U.S. has to lie about it. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is constantly making up stories and simply lying about statistics. And there's only one way. I mean, you can make an argument that there is legitimate hegemony for the U.S. concerning Canada or Mexico, maybe even Central America, but not the entire planet. It simply doesn't have that capacity. It doesn't have the resources. It's not even the same country that it was at the end of World War II, thanks to immigration and liberal ideology. Liberals destroy everything they touch, and that's the point, because the regime which controls the EU and the U.S. is an oligarchy. There's no republic. There's no democracy. There's nothing. It's an oligarchy. A handful of the wealthy in various different fields rule both the state and the society. They don't care about they're already billionaires. They don't care about prosperity. They care about asset stripping. There's always an island for them to go to. You know, this isn't about winning wars. This isn't about even making money. They've already done it. And so this is something written, you know, the American working man, especially the male American working man, could read this and say, yes, this is what's going on here. And liberalism, in whatever definition you want to use, is the ideological core of it. And the regime is just another word for global oligarchy. And Putin came to power and threw them in prison, and or threw them out of the country. And in China, they weren't really allowed to exist in the first place, but the West tried to enforce it and continue trying to force the oligarchs on them. But the state is simply strong enough there where they're not going to allow it. So they're the most rational. They're the best. Compared to the U.S., they are the best led societies because capital doesn't control the state in China or Russia. Capital does control the state in the U.S.
Well, evil always finally ends up destroying itself, I think. And I think that's what we're seeing happen, basically, to this liberal world order. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless, and hail victory.